Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Welcome to this edition of the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
And we have a lot to talk about this week, including a couple of potential blockbusters for kids and adults.
First up, we have a brilliant neurosurgeon going in search of a treatment for his damaged hands, and he gains mystical powers instead in Marvel's Doctor Strange.
Then after the Bergens invade Troll Village, Poppy, the happiest troll ever born, and the curmudgeonly Branch set off on a journey to rescue her friends in Trolls.
Director Mel Gibson is back with Hacksaw Ridge, the true story of a World War II hero who earned the Medal of Honor without ever touching a gun.
And hockey enforcers struggle to rise to the professional ranks of the NHL, only to have their role checked out of existence in the documentary Ice Guardians.
Plus, I may hit upon two other documentaries, The Uncondemned and All Governments Lie, because seriously, how often can I lay claim to having watched three documentaries in 1 week, Charlie?
Well, I don't know if I believe you. You haven't talked about them yet.
You're in for a shock.
All right, I lost the wine bet last week. We were on the subway coming home from Hacksaw Ridge. I had a headache that would kill other mortals. You were just handing out pills. We bet on the trolls running time. I lost. So, I have a choice for you. I matched two movies.
Yes.
We can A for Trolls, drink Gnarly Head Pinot Noir.
You know, that would also work for Mel Gibson's beard.
Oh, double work. And for Hacksaw Ridge, Sledgehammer, Cabernet Sauvignon.
Well, I'm going to go with Gnarly Head because I actually think it works for both movies.
Gnarly Head. All right, I'm going to open this while we're talking.
All right.
So what are we starting off with? Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the biggest hit of the week for the masses in terms of adults and fanboys and girls who are just anxiously awaiting this one.
Well, I know you're a big Marvel fan. In fact, I think you might be a bigger Marvel fan than I am, because every time a new Captain America number 7 comes out or Thor part 5 is you're all over it, and I was like, oh, I'm underwhelmed. And you know, I like the Guardians of the Galaxy. I thought was probably their most recent best.
Well, that's a different kind of Marvel movie. Oh, very good.
Hey.
I like Marvel movies more than the DC Comics ones because they're generally just lighter and more fun and more of just an experience at the movie theater that everyone just comes out there having really enjoyed it. So I like Doctor Strange. I like Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange, but I still like my Iron Man, Tony Stark type guy and my Captain America better. But it's a good movie.
It is good, but it's not deep. It's not profound. It's another origin story. We get a lot of origin stories with them. And it's not as physical. It's not as fist fighty, if you know what I'm saying, as the other Marvel blockbuster superhero films. It's metaphysical.
It's cerebral. It
is other dimensions. It's the multiverse. In fact, it's very Neil deGrasse Tyson explaining something to me for almost 2 hours is what it is. And Benedict Cumberbatch, you mentioned him. He's fine as a leading man. Two things I hated about it. His American accent.
I thought it was fine.
Do not make one of the best British actors of this generation talk in American drawl.
But
he's
he
a
pulls
British,
it off.
Yeah, but he shouldn't. He's a British guy with the best accent on earth. Don't do this. And they tried to be funny. They tried to be funny a lot. They tried to be Iron Man funny. Robert Downey Jr. had better lines, and he's just better at delivering funny. Doctor Strange tried to deliver funny lines, and he frequently had to ask, what do you mean you're not laughing? This is funny. Why aren't you laughing? And no one's laughing. It's not funny.
I chuckled. I thought it was funny. I needed those lines because the plot was certainly kind of above my head. And so I was okay with that. I thought he pulled them off. I thought he was sort of Tony Stark light in his cynicism and sarcasm. And I think that's what made the movie enjoyable for me. So I'm not a fanboy. I haven't read the comics. I didn't know this character at all. In fact, up until a month ago, I'd never heard of Doctor Strange. So for me to have at least enjoyed this movie on some level, that spoke a lot.
I didn't know about Doctor Strange either. I'd never heard of him, even though I guess the comic was started in 1963, so he's been around. This is the 14th Marvel movie, if you can believe that already.
Wow.
All the Iron Mans, Captain Americas, and Thors, and Avengers. Number 14. You mentioned he was a neurosurgeon. He's a very arrogant guy, like Tony Stark, mm-hmm. but in the medical field, he's very, very smart. He only does operations that will increase his fame. And he gets in a car accident because he drives too fast and he texts while driving.
A horrific car accident.
And his hands just, they're scarred over, they shake, he can't do the simplest surgeries. Western medicine fails him, so he goes east. He runs into Chiwetel Ejiofor, playing a man named Mordo. He says, "Follow me, I'm going to introduce you to the Ancient One," played by Tilda Swinton. And right there, Tilda Swinton steals the rest of the movie. She's the best character. She's the most intriguing character. Probably has the richest backstory. They don't really go into it. And I loved every minute she was on screen. And when she wasn't on screen, I was waiting for her to come back.
I mean, Tilda Swinton, she always picks very odd roles. And so this was odd. So I thought this was the best role for her to find in a mainstream movie because she does so many of those sort of twisted indies. But also Rachel McAdams is in it as sort of his love interest from the past. And what I liked is that she's a skilled surgeon or skilled doctor in her own right. And she sort of plays straight man to his character development and all these strange things that overcome his character. And she reacts the way that any of us would react. So that's her role in this movie, is to kind of be like, what happened to you, dude? So I thought she was pretty good in it, and Mads Mikkelsen. Well, hey, I was practicing Chiwetel Ejiofor to get his name pronounced correctly.
You've had years for that. He was 12 years a slave.
But so Mads is like the villain guy in this, and he just always seems to...
And he's a good villain.
He's a good Hannibal villain.
On television. He was Le Chiffre in Casino Royale. The man can play a villain.
Yeah.
He bled from his eyeballs in that movie, by the way.
Yeah, so it's not the best Marvel movie by far, but I think it serves its purpose. I think people that were looking forward to seeing it will. They should definitely see it in IMAX 3D. It's one of those few that I would actually say, yeah, you know, if you're going to go and experience this movie and all of its strangeness, then look for it in IMAX, because it was a much more immersive experience that way.
I liked the visuals actually more than the plot. It had, its 3D worked. It enhanced what it was supposed to enhance. It wasn't showy. They didn't spear anything through the screen at you. And the visuals, it was very, if you have vertigo, you might, you know, catch
yes,
a little disorientation.
Absolutely.
And buildings fold in on themselves, just like they did in Inception. If you remember Inception, it looks like they have a lot of inspiration from that. And this is going to be nominated for visual effects, hands
absolutely
down. It is stunning what they do with cityscapes that they play around with, and floor designs on the floor that expand and contract with their metaphysical hand waving gestures that they control the environment around them. I thought that was one of the best parts of the film.
Yeah, because the plot itself really made no sense. I was like, okay, there are these dimensions that these sorcerers guard the dimensions. And I was like, I don't really understand how this is all working, and how suddenly he can be in Nepal and the next day he's in New York.
He goes through the portal.
He goes through the portal, but the whole portal thing, it didn't quite track for me.
You wave your fingers in a circle and a portal opens up.
But that part is a bit of a mind stretch. But the other main character in this movie is that cloak. There's this cloak of levitation, and you could tell who knew the comics and who knew this character, because there was a total geek out that went on during the screening when that cloak first appeared and landed itself on Doctor Strange's shoulders. It was like, now he's Doctor Strange.
That cloak has more personality than some of the characters.
It's true. It was very funny, but I enjoy when people around me in a theater are absolutely enjoying part of a movie. And so that was definitely for the fans. And the other thing that's for the fans are the two teasers that come in the end credits. So everyone needs to be aware that you don't leave at any point if you want to see what might be coming down the pike until the very end of the end credits. So there's two special bonus scenes to watch out for.
Yeah, I know sometimes we sit through all the credits and you think there's going to be something and then there's not. So this time there is, like, all the way at the end. And I also heard someone explaining it's not a cape, it's a cloak.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you were saying cloak, you're good.
Did I say cloak?
You're fine, but I just heard someone say cape, and like, what do you mean cape? It's not a cape, it's a cloak.
It's a cloak, so, you know, a little, it's kind of like Harry Potter's cloak of invisibility or whatever. It
but
reminded
awesome.
Me a little of that. But more awesome. And so, yeah, I mean, it's fine for its fans. This should never be someone's first Marvel movie.
Well, they took a big risk here. The director, never done a Marvel film before. He's new, and he's from the horror genre. Scott Derrickson is his name. He did 2005's The Exorcism of Emily Rose, 2012's Sinister. I mean, really good, effective horror films, but usually not a genre tapped for talent to jump up with the big boys and spend, you know, $1 billion of Disney's money. They took a big risk, and I think it paid off. Mm-hmm. It's a little, the tone is different, and I think that's because of the new director. It feels like a different Marvel movie, but poor Mr. Derrickson got yelled at online by 1,000 bloggers. He is accused of what a lot of people are accused of now, whitewashing.
Oh, with the Ancient One.
The Ancient One in the comics was actually a little racist, a little stereotypical, an Asian guy with a Fu Manchu. And so he's not getting yelled at for making it female, but he made it white and female. It's no longer an Asian Ancient One. It's a almost albino Celtic Ancient One. So a lot of people are very angry that why didn't you cast an Asian in this role?
I think they need to get a life.
These are people, I guess, very familiar with the source material and on the lookout for this kind of stuff. I don't notice it. I didn't know that the Ancient One was supposed to be a Tibetan guru. I had no idea. And I think it worked. Just be happy you got Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, exactly.
She is the best part of the movie.
If anyone can pull off a sort of androgynous, what is this person supposed to be, it's a bald Tilda Swinton.
And I don't think the script did her justice. She was on the screen the requisite amount of time, but man, there's a lot of stuff they could have done with her, and she's just kind of a side performer.
Well, but I was glad that they actually brought this movie in just under 2 hours, because so many of these superhero movies now feel like they're epics and they go on and on. And so I thought it was a tight enough movie, and each character got their due. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say we haven't seen the last of Doctor Strange.
I would rather see a movie called The Ancient One than Doctor Strange. That's how good she was.
I think a lot of people will disagree because it's Benedict Cumberbatch.
Next up, Trolls. Animated film. My one sentence encapsulation of this was, Trolls is the cinematic experience of like sucking on a Sour Patch Kid. It's in your face. It's obnoxious. It's sugary. It's like Halloween candy. It's sucking on Halloween candy is how happy it is.
It's that happiness you feel in the moment when you're digging through your candy and you're like, oh, thank God it's a Reese's versus, you know, a generic Hershey bar. So it's a sweet movie. It is fun in the moment and it is fleeting happiness, but I think that's okay. I smiled throughout this entire movie. I thought other people were really enjoying it. The soundtrack is phenomenal. And I just really think it's going to be a good one for the family to go to. The adults will get a kick out of it on a completely different level than the kids.
Trolls do three things. They sing, dance, and hug, and repeat. In fact, they have watches that go off on the hour to remind them to hug. And it's actually half, you brought the music, it's half musical. In fact, they go on a big, long adventure to rescue some trolls who got kidnapped. And half of that adventure, more than half, is Poppy, voiced by Anna Kendrick, singing the plot. Here I am running through and I'm jumping over here and gotta watch out for this and I'm happy and I'm gonna rescue them. She's just singing the plot.
Yeah.
That is annoying.
What's wrong with that? I think that's what made this movie work for me, because every time they stopped singing, I thought it dragged a little bit when they were not singing. And I found myself just, you know, waiting for them to start the next song. In fact, I was begging for them to start the next song when the movie took kind of a dark turn for a few minutes. And the little girl next to you started wailing.
She lost it.
Sobbing uncontrollably. And all I kept thinking was, start singing. please start singing and relieve this girl, because
that's how you know it worked for that audience.
Well, but it's it did. It got a little scary for a little while there. I mean, this is the plot.
Well, this is probably the child's like fourth film ever. She doesn't know that no matter what, the trolls were going to win. Like, I don't care what happens, the trolls are going to come out on top.
Yeah, but what kind of premise is it where you have these creatures called the Bergens that are always miserable, except for in their history, the one time of year that they'd be happy was when they ate happy trolls.
That's like a Grimm's fairy tale.
The Trollstice, you know.
Like, they have an old witch shoving Hansel and Gretel in an oven. So you can't handle some Bergen, some troll-like creatures, eating trolls. And throughout the whole thing, they talk about eating trolls. You only see it happen one time. One troll gets eaten, and it's in like flashback mode. And the Bergens, thank you for bringing them up, are far more interesting and fun to watch than the trolls.
Well, they're different. Then you have, is it Zooey Deschanel who plays the scullery maid, Bridget, I believe. So she strikes a deal with the trolls at some point, you know, that she'll help them escape. But this is where your love story comes in for the trolls movie, is that the trolls will help the scullery maid find happiness with this midget king.
Completely superfluous
it's
to the movie.
It's a B-plot. It's an absolute
B-story. The trolls
B-story have,
you know, there's no spoiling trolls. The trolls figure it out, and they save each other about halfway through. And then Bridget, the scullery maid, may or may not get in trouble for losing the trolls. So they stay. They stay put to help Bridget have a makeover and try to get the king to notice her and fall in love. That's half of the film.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
But it triggers some of the more fun musical numbers. And this has a soundtrack that's absolutely fun for anyone like me who grew up with the music of the 80s. You have some Simon and Garfunkel. You have Cyndi Lauper's True Colors, you know, the troll versions.
The covers were better than the original songs. When she breaks into... I liked... My favorite ones were the covers. The Sound of Silence... The best one was Zooey Deschanel singing Lionel Richie's Hello.
Yes.
That was fantastic.
Yeah.
And we've heard it a million times before. It's still considered an original. Justin Timberlake's Can't Stop the Feeling. That, man, that song still stinks.
No, it doesn't. Man. It's still very infectious. And so Justin Timberlake, you can't really fault. I mean, this is, talk about your killer casting for an animated movie's voices. You have Justin Timberlake is the curmudgeonly troll that you probably identify with, Charlie.
I understood where Branch was coming from.
I figured as much.
Because he knows, in the beginning, the trolls escape. They were all held prisoner in this tree by the Bergens. They escape for 20 years, and no one remembers that they used to get gobbled up by Bergens, except Branch. So good on him for remembering, hey, folks, there's still a threat out there.
That's right. But having Justin Timberlake's voice, it was a good way, you know, months before this movie came out, people were already singing and dancing to Can't Stop the Feeling. Ugh. Which it symbolizes the infectiousness of this movie. And it's just fun. It'll just make you smile and for 90 minutes, and then you leave and you're like, okay. That was, and also very colorful.
Well, I do like the look. It's not, you think it'd be 100% lame CGI computers, and it's not. I saw felt, I saw velvet, I saw macrame. So whenever you have fire, it's actually really interesting. It looks like macrame, like with a fan on it. So it's a good looking film, but Trolls is a knockoff. The Bergens look like the Box Trolls, a far better film from like 2 years ago. And the co-directors, Mike Mitchell and Walt Dorn, they're from Knockoff Central. Shrek the Third and Shrek Forever After. It doesn't get much more knockoff than that. And so they're just like, hey, these guys know how to steal stuff. Bring them on in.
No, I thought it was fine. I mean, this one does not rise to the level of a Shrek by any means.
Well, it actually matches the last two god-awful Shreks.
Well, I don't count those. But if you think about the original Shrek. But I also think that I think the soundtrack will take off. I suspect a lot of people will seek out the soundtrack. And again, I don't think it'll become a classic, but I think any kids and adults that go see it just to have a little bit of a quick escape, they'll enjoy it. It's nice. I did not like Box Trolls personally. I thought that one was much darker.
Box Trolls is the best animated film of that year. It was so good.
But I don't think the little kids would agree with you.
I don't care if little kids like the movie or not. It was a great animated film.
I think an animated movie that's aimed towards the G and PG audience should absolutely be entertaining for that target audience.
What about my favorite line of Trolls? There's no way that is suitable for the four-year-olds. For the rest of the day, I learned that when you see a pretty girl, you're supposed to look at her and yell,
Hot lunch!
And I thought I was going to continue that forever, and I've stopped because it actually isn't that catchy. But for a while it was. Hot lunch!
Like the movie, it was catchy
in
the moment.
So appropriate, Hannah.
No. I'm saying there are different levels. So some people, the adults, watched it and could get different things out of it. There were plenty of things that I was grateful flew way over the heads of the kids in the audience. But what I'm saying is that the colors, the music, the general idea of this movie, that is what the kids will like. And there's enough there for the adults to get something out of it too. And that's what makes it work for me. Again, it's not one that I'd go seek out and see multiple times. I might listen to some of the songs again. But it's not one of those ones that is going to stick with me for years on end.
And since it sounds like you're fishing for troll compliments, it's better than Norm of the North. It's better than Ratchet and Clank. It's better than Angry Birds. Actually, it reminded me a lot of Angry Birds for whatever reason. But
it's better than Angry Birds. Yeah, but it's fun. It's just sheer fun. And if you look at
it's overdose.
But if you it's like trick or treating on Halloween, and you gorge on that candy, and then the next day you feel a little queasy, but it was still good in the moment.
Speaking of feeling queasy, I saw half the audience in the second half of Hacksaw Ridge covering their eyes and ears. Ears because, man, that was really loud in the theater we saw it in. But eyes because, good Lord, sinew, tendons, cartilage, limbs, heads, flying all over the screen, Hannah.
I was part of that half that had my eyes covered for the entire second half of this movie. Hacksaw Ridge with Andrew Garfield playing a World War II vet who was a conscientious objector but was so determined to serve that he was able to become an Army medic. And it's his story, and it's a really interesting combination biopic, drama, romance, war movie. So it was kind of like two movies in one. The first half was a very different movie than the second half.
I broke it into thirds: the home front, boot camp, and the war. And it's Mel Gibson, Mad Max himself, lethal weapon himself, knows how to direct a war film. And it's probably why they kept sending him this script. He directed Scottish Rebels in Braveheart, a brutal axe-wielding movie. He directed We Were Soldiers, a brutal Vietnam battle, and he directed Apocalypto, probably the most violent film ever made.
Yeah, which I had skipped.
And
Passion of the Christ, you know, that one had a little bloodshed in it too,
yes,
I believe.
A little bit. And so Andrew Garfield plays Desmond Doss. He's this aw shucks do-gooder out there in Lynchburg, Virginia. And he's got that accent, the Brit, Andrew Garfield, I believe. I think he's British.
He's American British.
Good Lord.
Grew up in London.
He has got that backwater accent. And he grows up a rough and tumble kid. He's kind of violent. And one stray blow sends his, almost kills his brother. So that and his Seventh-day Adventism convince him, no violence, no guns, no nothing. I'm a good boy. And we know this because the first time we see him as an adult, he's fixing a church window, so he is a good boy.
Well, and he's also always staring at the framed Ten Commandments in his living room. So, you know, whole thou shalt not kill thing was kind of staring you in the face from the get-go.
And he always has to jump between mom and dad. Mom, Rachel Griffiths, cowering in fear because dad, PTSD great war vet, played by Hugo Weaving, likes to wave around the family firearm when he likes to tie one on. So he learns, I would rather protect than hurt. Okay, I get it, fine. And he thinks the best way he can serve in World War II is to join the army, tell them, please don't give me a rifle, I just want to patch people up. You guys cool?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, what would be wrong with joining the army and in your unit is this guy who doesn't believe in working on Saturdays on his Sabbath and also doesn't want to pick up a gun. I'd be a little concerned that they might not have my back. But that's what's so fascinating about this very true story is he becomes this hero and he single-handedly essentially saves about 75 guys by one, bringing them down to safety off this ridge in Okinawa in 1945. And so It's a great story. It's a decent film, but a great story.
It is a very good story. It's kind of well done. Mel Gibson didn't have a lot of money. Since he's Mel Gibson and has a lot of baggage, there was no major studio funding here, and it shows. On the battlefield, the most important part of the film, the camera is up people's noses and in their face. It's very tactical. There was no pullback Steven Spielberg epic shot. This could be an epic war movie, but he couldn't pull back. He's in the middle of a dairy farm in Australia. You would see the house and the barn. And I noticed, just pull back already. Please pull back. And he can't. And, oh, man, that shackles the movie.
Yeah, I mean, because it's, when all this stuff is going on, it's a lot of tight shots. So I think maybe they just tried to make sure the whole thing was shot tight so you wouldn't notice when those epic scenes happened that you're not necessarily pulling back as far as any normal movie would. So it's the whole thing is just a very close-up kind of vibe. But I think you have – it's really well acted, and I love Andrew Garfield. I think he is just insanely versatile. I mean, you think about him – there was a lot of backlash when he first appeared as a new Spider-Man, and it was like, do we really need another Spider-Man?
We didn't.
The answer was no, but he was very good anyway. And so he's good as Spider-Man and Peter Parker. I loved him in 99 Homes last year, the indie. And he has just shown himself to be very, very versatile, and he can speak in the various American accents. He can speak in his native British accent. But how, no matter how you slice it, he's just really good at these roles and making you feel very empathetic and sympathetic towards him. So I enjoyed the story. It made me want to go find out more about him. And I did. I then went and found on YouTube the documentary that Doss was the subject of called The Conscientious Objector. There's also a This Is Your Life episode that was done a few years after he had won the Medal of Honor. And so there's a lot of stuff out there that really helps you get more of the real story. And there is a good deal of dramatic license taken in this story, but the heart of the story is true.
Well, the biggest license probably is the cinema romance timeline. Right before, really, he enlists, he meets the girl, Dorothy, played by Teresa Palmer, another Australian. This movie's full of Australians.
From The Choice, you'll remember.
They fall in love in about 10 days and agree to get married after boot camp, but before he ships off to war. And so, of course, they set up that scene at the bus station. You come back to me, you hear? And you just knew that scene was coming. And you're right about Andrew Garfield. He's the best actor in the film. He was very good. The guy who was in a tricky spot was Vince Vaughn.
Oh, right.
Vince Vaughn plays the drill sergeant. So there's only one drill sergeant now in history from 1987's Full Metal Jacket, Arlie Ermey. You only think of him as the drill sergeant. Anyone else is just playing Arlie Ermey.
Oh, I think
Ermey.
Of Louis Gossett Jr.
Mayonnaise. And unfortunately, Vince Vaughn has to step in these guys' shadow and do his version of what they've already done to perfection. And he does it okay. He's got his opening strut through the barracks, giving people nicknames, and that's where, you know, they're trying to set up the supporting characters so you recognize them later on, and you don't. There's the short Italian guy named Vito, there's a guy named Tex, and there's the naked guy named Hollywood who looks, you know, he's really good looking with a lot of muscles, and so they do that because you're supposed to recognize them on the battlefield, and it's so chaotic, and there's so many explosions, and it's so loud, I didn't recognize anybody, really, except Vince Vaughn and Andrew Garfield. Now, everyone else bled together.
That's
actually
true.
Ooh, bled together. Yes.
Bled together. They really did bleed together. But I agree. I completely lost track of who was who in those foxholes and stuff when they've got all the mud on their faces. I could not tell who was who. All I knew is that it really wasn't until the last 10 minutes of the movie that I actually figured out who had survived.
And yeah, this movie is a little polarizing when it comes to the battle. Our friend Christian Haymaker, 5 out of 5. He said he's introduced a recent new star rating, and it's his first 5-star film. He loved this movie. On the other hand, John Armstrong, Dr. Mathicus himself, hated this movie. You know, he said he didn't need the shot where one guy's face gets blown across another guy's face, and, you know, it's...
And the maggots and the guts and the...
Yeah, we see all the American heroes, but, you know, the enemy, the Japanese, they're just... They're blurs. Numbers. They're just numbers, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, a lot, you know, people react to this movie in different ways. Our screening was very unique. Mel Gibson was there with his beard, and Vince Vaughn was there.
And Luke Bracey.
Luke Bracey plays Smitty, the conflict guy. Made up, by the way. Smitty's not real. And the audience was a very DC audience. Rick Santorum, Oliver North,
yeah.
The Deputy Secretary of Defense, Robert Work, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Michelle Flournoy. A lot of staffers were there, Senator staffers. And then, you know, this movie, so there was, you know, right wing and left wing in that audience.
And the location.
The location was the Burke Theater at the US Navy Memorial. So, you know, when you go out into the lobby, there's, you know, naval history from the first frigates to the latest nuclear submarine in there. And it's, you know, it was a good place to watch a war film, a loud place to watch a war film, very interesting audience to watch it with. I had fun. If you like war movies, World War II movies, or Andrew Garfield, this is probably up your alley. If you don't like a lot of violence, this ain't for you.
You have to be prepared to just sort of avert your eyes for a big chunk of the second half. So it's like, yeah, I mean, some of those scenes put Saving Private Ryan's opening 20 minutes to shame.
They were on par.
I thought that
I saw intestines on both of them.
Yeah, they were on par. So if you think back and if you saw Saving Private Ryan and that opening scene absolutely killed you, then be prepared.
It's longer than that scene. It's half the film, and it's not as good.
Yeah, well, but I think it's appropriate to what the story is. But it's not for the faint of heart at all. But the first half of the movie is like a more traditional biopic drama
romance
movie.
Reminded me of The Notebook.
Yeah, so it suddenly veers from The Notebook into Saving Private Ryan. But so if you can balance the two, then it's interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about people that are not seeing it strictly as a reaction to Mel Gibson's history and his anti-Semitic rants. I think, you know, I go, well, Andrew Garfield's Jewish, so, you know, they kind of cancel each other out. Why not let yourself see Andrew Garfield and forget the fact that it was Mel Gibson directed? So,
yeah, a lot of baggage.
There's a lot of baggage, and I think, unfortunately, I do think that might hurt the movie a little bit at the box office.
Yeah, it's probably going to come in third this weekend. I think it's the best of the three that we've talked about, and I think it's going to come in third.
Yeah, it definitely will come in third, if not fourth, by some mystery other movie that might
probably
Madea Halloween.
The
Madea Halloween movie will still manage to somehow float near the top.
So someone else, just like Mel Gibson, who is misunderstood, is the one documentary I saw that you also saw this week. It's called Ice Guardians. It's about hockey. It's about a very special kind of hockey, the enforcer, the guy you don't hire to score goals. It's the guy you hire to scare the other team who, if they, you know, get out of line, hit your all-star a little too hard, he's the guy who's going to meet you in the center of the rink, throw the gloves off, and pound you in the face. Hannah, I love sports. I watch a lot of them. I love sports documentary. I had a blast watching this thing.
Did you?
Oh, I had so much fun.
I was surprised. I kind of tuned out at first. This is one of those ones where I watched the first 15 minutes, and then I stopped because I felt it was so inside hockey. But then I took a break, and I went back and I watched the rest. And I think it's too long for a documentary. First of all, it was nearly 2 hours. So for such a very specific subject matter, it went on kind of long. But it was certainly interesting. I mean, it pays homage. It has a point of view.
It loves its subject.
It loves its subject. And I mean, who knew that there was like a hockeyfights.com as one of their talking heads is the head of that website. But I really didn't know that this was like a sanctioned role in the NHL in the 70s, you know, basically going back before.
Your Washington Capitals, your local team, has an enforcer. His name's Tom Wilson.
But the enforcers aren't as, they can't get away with what they used to get away with.
No, the NHL has, due to outside pressure, has cracked down on all the fighting hockey was notorious for, imperiling the jobs of these gentlemen.
Yeah, and so it really talks about how these guys loved what they did. They loved getting beaten up. They loved beating up other people. They loved protecting the guys who did the scoring. But you absolutely need to have a basic like, if not love, of hockey. And I do think it felt like you needed to already kind of already know that those Philadelphia Flyers fans were a force to be reckoned with in the 80s. They still are, but back then even more so. And you got to know your Gretzky's and just how it came to be. What was fascinating to me was that you had this role that these hockey players who would not otherwise, the idea was that they could not otherwise make it into the NHL as goal scorers. And they were these brutes. And they were so excited as just fans of the game to be able to make it to the NHL. And this was their route to the NHL. And so essentially where the movie takes you is talking about how these guys who were just a fiercely loyal bunch who loved what they did were kind of pushed out of the game, and that role had basically been written out of the NHL.
Ice Guardians is so effective because we finally see the other point of view. Every year at the beginning of hockey season, we see the sports commentators outlaw fighting, ban fighting. You get in big trouble in football, baseball, and basketball if you fight. You get suspended. But hockey, they're encouraged to do it. Why is that? Well, you know what? On the other side, you finally hear, in Europe hockey, they're not allowed to fight. And the All-Stars get injured far more often. In the U.S., they don't. The amazing super hockey star for Pittsburgh, Sidney Crosby, gets injured all the time. Pittsburgh doesn't have an enforcer. No one's afraid to knock Sidney around because Brutus isn't going to come hurt them. If you push Alexander Ovechkin, Tom Wilson is coming to knock your teeth out, and you probably won't do it. And that, it appears by the numbers and stats, is true. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, no, it was definitely an interesting subject and one you definitely would not have necessarily heard before. And it did not even aim to really counterbalance the perspective. It was not a news story about, whether or not the rules of the game need to be changed to protect players against concussions. It really is saying these guys did a job. Like, this was their job. They were good at their job. They loved their job. And if they could still be doing it, they would in a heartbeat.
You see,
even
at the
if they
table,
lost all their teeth.
And they're talking to their kids, and it's like, yeah, it is my job. Daddy's going to go get in a fight tonight.
Yeah. And so it is. It's for those fans who always, the old adage, I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out. That's really what this movie is about. And I do think anyone who really knew hockey in the 70s and 80s especially will enjoy this, but it feels a lot like one of those ESPN documentaries. And so,
and I laughed. Yeah. Like they brought up the word goon.
Yeah, the
people
goon.
The enforcers sometimes called goons, and they're like, they actually take big offense, like, don't call me a goon, we prefer enforcer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it's an interesting one, and it's going to be a little hard to find. I think it has like a limited release in DC this week, but it'll be out on video on demand in February. So, if you don't find it anywhere near you, then just hang tight till February, which will be a really good time of year to maybe watch a ice hockey documentary.
Yeah, I was not really looking forward to this. I just had a blast.
Yeah, I'm glad
it's
you
just
enjoyed
so
it.
Much fun.
I didn't like absolutely love seeing these guys get their get their noses smashed in and their teeth cracked multiple times, but
it is so much better than the thing you want to talk about next, which I believe is All Governments Lie.
And you did watch it, didn't you?
I did, and it's a propaganda film and a commercial, and I didn't like it at all.
See, I really liked it, and Artie Chick on chickflix.net actually just had written her review today, and she liked it too. So it's two against one, Charlie.
Doesn't mean I'm wrong.
No, I think it does. It's called All Governments Lie: Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone.
Ugh.
And so I.F. Stone was this guy who was an independent journalist, a investigative journalist back in, I guess, like the 50s, 60s, 70s. He did this I.F. Stone weekly newsletter that became just sort of a favorite read for inspired people like Michael Moore, who now does all these.
And he's so humble. He says, you know what? I like to think I'm today's I.F. Stone.
Well, but it's...
Way to go, brother.
It's really... The message of this movie is that I.F. Stone had a knack of saying, all governments lie. It's just the way it is. And it's
he's right. They do.
They do. And it's the role of the press and the journalists to ferret out the truth and to figure that out. And to expose the truth when governments lie. And that it really is taking the stand that mainstream media, that the resources and the time that independent journalists are often now getting in order to do some real investigative reporting, those resources and time are not there for the mainstream media person. It's just the nature of the beast right now. And so I just really enjoy this movie, and I think maybe because I was a journalism major, and I feel like this is the kind of movie that that they should show in journalism schools to just really inspire, to reinforce the importance of having multiple sources. I had a instructor who said, you know, if your mother says she loved you, check it out. And that was his view, is you needed to get multiple sources, multiple confirmations on things, and not just take the word of... not just governments, but anyone who just force feeds you a paper statement or a press conference or a brief daily briefing. You're not supposed to just be okay with whatever you're fed. You're supposed to actually follow up.
Our country and any open society does need independent journalists and hardcore, hard-hitting, investigative journalists. When All Governments Lie talks about that, it works. It's good. But when it says, by the way, I just created this new show and this website, you should really check it out. Stop. You're so grandiose. Stop. Patting yourselves on the back. It's when they have the best example in the film. Sorry, Congresswoman, we have to cut away from you right now. Justin Bieber's just been arrested. You're right. News is now entertainment, and it's not serving America like Walter Cronkite used to do. But All Governments Lie isn't about that. It's about Democracy Now and the Young Turks.
See, I don't think that's what it's about. I think you're right that there are moments in this movie where it becomes an extended commercial for Democracy Now and the Young Turks. And I felt that too. I absolutely did. And I wish they had pulled back on that a bit, because that did diminish the point. I still think that the movie filmmakers did a really good job of being so timely and current. They obviously probably tacked on a new first 10 minutes of this movie to reflect what's happening in politics today. And so I appreciated that. I thought it was very well paced, and that they did a very good job of inserting very timely material into the film. And so I think it's good, and I think that anybody who liked Snowden, for instance, will probably like this documentary. And I do think that that it would be an inspiring movie for journalism students to learn about I.F. Stone and what he used to do, and how his legacy is sort of being preserved through these independent journalists.
You would be better served watching Michael Moore's last year's documentary, if you haven't seen it yet, Where to Invade Next, or this year's documentary called Wiener, about Anthony Weiner's unsuccessful run for New York mayor.
But if you like a good political documentary, then I think it's worth seeing this one, too. I don't think you need to pick one over the other. What was that one that came out recently where I was like, I said, nobody's going to see this, and you were like, it should be shown in... It was on college, the education, the one about higher education.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, this is sort of that similar thing where it's not going to be widely viewed, but folks who are into a political documentary and journalism, they're going to enjoy this if they see it.
Meh.
And as is also the case, because there was one more that I saw called The Uncondemned. So I guess you didn't have a chance to see that one yet, huh, Charlie?
I work, Hannah.
So anyway, touche. The Uncondemned, it's called. And talk about your journalists who are doing some investigative reporting. Essentially, this movie was made by a woman, full disclosure, was somebody who used to work at Headline News. It was probably, I think she must have started there soon after I left there. But I had heard about this documentary because there were quite a few people from my CNN and Headline News days that had some hand in this movie. And so it's fascinating. It's this documentary about a group of young international lawyers and activists who built the case that led to the first prosecution for rape as a war crime and an act of genocide. And that was all during the stemming back to the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, where the Hutus and the Tutsis were fighting each other. And it took a little while to get into the rhythm of the movie, but ultimately it was very rewarding. And you saw how these young prosecutors built this case, and eventually how these brave women testified in the trial against this Rwandan politician who had who was at least, if not, you know, who was implicit or complicit in the in rape and other war crimes. And he ended up getting convicted, and it was sort of unprecedented in this international tribunal. And and he's serving a life sentence. And so it's a really fascinating film about a story that I think a lot of people really are not aware of or lost track of from the mid-90s. And it, to me, is one of those films that serves as a perfect blueprint for a featured drama someday. Like, I can see it being put onto the big screen as a feature film, using this documentary to sort of write the screenplay.
It sounds like subject matter we would have seen on that documentary we saw about like 3 weeks ago called Camera Person. It just feels like this would have popped up.
But this, it does, you get like a slight glimmer of that. But what makes this one's really well paced, and you could tell it was put together by somebody who was used to putting together a news segment, because it is all done through sound bites. And so there's no narration to the story. It's these people telling the story of what they went through back in the mid-90s, putting this case together, and the ups and downs, and how it was really they were expected to lose. They really did not think that they were going to win this unprecedented case, because even though rape was on the books as a potential war crime, it had never been prosecuted before. And this was the first time that there was a prosecution, and it was successful. And so it just sets this great precedent in international law that systematic raping is punishable as a war crime.
Well, there's a lot of different, diverse opportunities this week to check out documentaries. You know, pick your poison.
Yeah.
You got everything from rape as a war crime to investigative journalism to hockey.
That's right. And then you got your big feature films, too, so.
So to wrap it up, we actually started way back there with a Marvel movie, the new superhero Doctor Strange. Welcome, breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I mean, hey, if you already have seen all the others and you like those superhero flicks, add this one to the pile.
Trolls, it's only worth it for the tunes.
Shiny, happy people.
Hacksaw Ridge, best film of the week. Check it out.
Yeah, I don't know if it was better than Doctor Strange. I think it's for a different audience, but if you like a biopic war movie, then it's worth checking out.
Out of the two documentaries I saw, I would pick Ice Guardians, because, man, that's just fun. You don't even have to like hockey to enjoy that.
I probably would pick The Uncondemned.
All governments lie.
It's good.
This movie lies.
No. It's, the truth is out there, Charlie.
It's so X-Files of you. And The Uncondemned.
The Uncondemned, yeah. It's you know, anyone who remembers Rwanda and the genocide and goes, whatever happened with that, it's an untold story. So I would not be surprised to eventually see this in a few years as a feature film.
Well, consider this story told. Thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash this week. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you for listening.
Ciao.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.